Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, July 18, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call as we debate the use of settlement funds in federal matters. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two experts to our call today. We'll hear opening remarks from each. We'll hear first from Mr. Paul J. Larkin, Jr. He's the Senior Legal Research Fellow at the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. He will be followed by Professor David Min, who is an Assistant Professor of Law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law. We'll hear, as I mentioned, opening remarks from each of about 8 to 10 minutes, maybe a little back and forth, but as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions, so please do be thinking of those questions as we move through the program. With that, Mr. Larkin, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Professor Min and I are going to speak today about a practice that the Justice Department has developed over the last two administrations. It's very common for parties, including the federal government, to settle cases rather than bring them to trial. In fact, oftentimes it's better to settle it than bring it to trial. But unfortunately, what's happened is, in the process of settling cases, the Justice Department has pursued a practice that, in my view, is quite troublesome. Let me give you an example from a private lawsuit to tell you about the sort of troublesome practice the Justice Department has been engaged in. Let's assume the listeners out there have been involved in an accident or have been defrauded or have failed to receive some goods they purchased. So you hire a lawyer and the lawyer goes to court to represent you. The other side agrees to settle and you're due whatever money you were supposed to get. Let's say it's $1 million. What the lawyer for you can't do is the following. He can't say to the opposing counsel, look, my client is wealthy. He doesn't need the $1 million. $750,000 is plenty. So why don't we do this? You keep $250,000 and give that to an organization that you pick from a list I'll give you, or you just pick it yourself. I don't care what happens. I'm not going to look into it afterwards. You give me the $750,000. That's fine because that's really all my client needs. No private lawyer could do that. A private lawyer is supposed to represent assiduously the interests of his client and not give away money that the other side is going to give to the client. The problem with the Justice Department's practice is that in that circumstance, everyone who is a member of the public is the client. And what the Justice Department is doing is giving away money that is due to the client. Because what the department is doing is saying to defendants, you don't need to give me all the money you're willing to pay to settle this case. You can give it to private organizations on a list that I'll give you or that you can select on your own. The problem with that is that it violates both the Constitution and various federal statutes. Let me go through them in order. The federal appropriations process is both constitutional and statutory in its nature. The constitutional part is the appropriations clause. The text of the clause says that, quote, no money shall be drawn from the Treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law. It's quite clear that what Congress was trying to do was make sure that it and only it was responsible for the payment of money from the federal government to other parties. That was the practice that had developed in England, and that was the practice in all or many of the states before our nation was founded. The framers wanted to make sure that the legislature had the authority to engage in this sort of practice because it was the one that was most directly representative of everyone in the nation. Now, to implement that, there are two statutes that were passed. One is called the Anti-Deficiency Act, the other the Miscellaneous Receipts Act. The Anti-Deficiency Act says the government can't run up a debt of any type. It can only hand out the money that Congress has appropriated in the different appropriations bills. Complementary is the Miscellaneous Receipts Act. It provides that any money the government gets control of, or to use the slang, gets its hands on, has to be deposited into the U.S. Treasury. What that would mean is any money the government gets in a settlement has to be deposited into the Treasury so that the House and the Senate can decide how it will be paid out, not the executive branch and not the Justice Department. Reinforcing that requirement is a third statute called the McDade Amendment. Named after a congressman who was prosecuted and acquitted, the McDade Amendment requires the Justice Department lawyers up and down from the rookie who has just showed up to the Attorney General comply with state ethics requirements. And as I mentioned at the outset, state ethics requirements require that someone pay the strictest attention to the duty of loyalty that any lawyer has. The problem with the Justice Department then and its practice is that it amounts to the appropriation of money in violation of the Appropriations Clause, the failure to pay money into the Treasury, as literally required by the Miscellaneous Receipts Act and implicitly required by the Appropriations Clause and Anti-Deficiency Act. And so doing, it amounts to unethical practice, unethical lawyering, which would violate the McDade Amendment. Now, the Supreme Court has been willing to read certain provisions in the Constitution rather liberally, but it has read the Appropriations Clause quite literally. The Appropriations Clause and those statutes prohibit the Justice Department from engaging in this practice. And we're not talking about, you know, a penny ante matter here. Billions of dollars were at stake in the housing cases that were settled either in 2014 or 2015. Those are billions of dollars that our elected representatives are responsible for handing out, not lawyers at the Justice Department who've not been elected to any office. Now, my colleague disagrees with me, and so to give him the opportunity now to rebut, I'm going to turn it over to him.
Great. Thank you, Paul, for, I think, a great job of introducing the topic. So I'm going to basically launch along two different lines of argument. First, I'm just going to briefly talk about why this practice, which actually goes past far past the past two administrations and goes back to the 1970s, of having settlements between the federal government and private parties in litigation involving government claims include payments to third-party charities or what I call charitable payment provisions. So the first question we have to ask is, are these legal? And I think that is a clear matter today. I think that Dr. Larkin's analysis, while interesting, is a bit of a stretch as to where the law stands today. But then I want to talk more about what the policy matter should be. Should we have these? And I think that's actually quite an interesting question. I think that we should, and I'll talk about why in just a moment. So first I want to come back to the question of should these charitable payment provisions be legal? And so Dr. Larkin talks about the appropriations authority. Running up against that in this type of instance is the well-understood authority of the executive branch, the plenary authority, in deciding how to handle litigation involving the federal government. And that plenary power includes the power to compromise and settle litigation involving the federal government. And the only limitations on that authority are statutes that specifically and expressly relate to the litigation authority of the executive branch or attorney general. Or more generally, Article 2, Section 3 of the Constitution, which imposes a duty on the president to faithfully execute the laws of the United States. Now, of course, Article 1 clearly lays out Congress's exclusive power of appropriations, and so not surprisingly, throughout history, we've seen a lot of different instances of Congress and the president butting heads. And so how do we deal with the appropriations authority versus the litigation authority of the president? The Miscellaneous Receipts Act, which Dr. Larkin describes, lays out a fairly clear line. And what it says is that any official or agent of the government receiving money for the government from any source shall deposit the money in the Treasury. Now, Dr. Larkin claims that that requires any settlement to deposit the monies into the Treasury, but that's not how the courts, the GAO, which represents Congress, or the White House Office of Legal Counsel, going back to 1980 and then beyond under Reagan, George Bush 1, George Bush 2, Clinton, and Obama, of course, have interpreted this matter. The key question is whether we've actually received the money. And that receipt of money need not actually be actual. It can also be constructive. And so the courts have found at times that two factors matter. First, that the settlement must be made before finding of liability or admission of guilt. and there must be no government post-settlement control of the funds. If those two factors are met, the government is said to be so attenuated from the funds in question that there's no constructive receipt, and these types of settlements can be they are perfectly permissible under the law. There's an additional requirement that the GAO has said is important, and the executive branch has issued guidance to its agencies to follow, which is that there should be some nexus between the payment in question and the agency's prosecutorial goals and the underlying alleged legal violation. But as long as you have all these different factors met, nobody's found a problem with this legally. And so we've had, again, these types of settlements going back till the 1970s. Again, the courts have approved of these types of settlements. You have GAO and OLC saying the same thing. Now, the poster boy for why we might view these types of settlements as a problem is the recent MBS settlements that Dr. Larkin notes. And these have been characterized as a slush fund to liberal groups because they call for some payments to groups like La Raza or NeighborWorks or NAACP. But it is worth noting that upon closer inspection, these deals actually do satisfy the requirements that I talked about, but also that upon closer scrutiny, they're actually pretty well designed, and they've largely been mischaracterized in the debates around these types of charitable payment provisions. When you look at them, the provisions in question actually call for millions of dollars, not billions, so they're actually about 0.1% of the settlements in question. Only three of the five banks that settled actually agreed to these types of provisions. And what they actually agreed to is to make donations to do foreclosure prevention by sending money to housing counseling groups. They had a list of hundreds of different housing counseling groups they could send money to. This included, of course, the groups like La Raza and NeighborWorks, but also included a number of Catholic charities, other religious groups, groups that you might characterize as more conservative in nature. The common thread underlying who could receive this money was not some sort of ideological litmus test, but rather their proven effectiveness in preventing foreclosures, which, of course, was the goal of this type of settlement, which I think is completely reasonable given the alleged violation related to the RMBS in question. Another objection we've seen is that this takes money away from taxpayers. Dr. Larkin himself has once put it, any sum that the government demands that a corporation hand over to a private party is money that the corporation will otherwise pay into the federal treasury. I want to point out that's not actually what's typically happening, and the RMBS settlements are a good example of that. What ends up happening is the federal government runs up against these civil penalty limits, and oftentimes will, instead of seeking the max civil penalty, might seek a little less in civil penalties in exchange for a lot more in third-party charitable payments. And so the RMBS settlements, which were for maybe billions of dollars in relief, are a good example of this, because the actual statute that was alleged to be violated in these instances was FIREA, which caps its violations at $1 million per civil penalty violation. And so it's not clear that DOJ would have procured more in civil penalties than it received from the RMBS settlements. In fact, I think it's quite unlikely. And so to say that there's some sort of one-for-one here, that we're taking money away from taxpayers to give it to third-party charities, is really not an accurate description of what's happening. So I really think that this is a solution in search of a problem. At the same time, I think that eliminating charitable payment provisions, as Dr. Larkin suggests, and of course there's a House bill right now, H.R. 5063, proposed by the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Bob Goodlatte, which would actually eliminate these types of charitable payment provisions and not allow DOJ and other federal agencies to negotiate for these. But I think if you see that elimination of charitable payment provisions, you're likely to see some very detrimental effects. First of all, it would undermine the deterrence and compensation goals of settlements that are negotiated by DOJ. Because DOJ can negotiate for larger settlements with these charitable payment provisions, that allows it to more effectively serve its own goals of deterrence and general compensation. Now, Dr. Larkin gives the example of you know, your own lawyer couldn't do this. This is a breach of the duty of loyalty. The problem with that analysis is that government lawyers are not the same as your or my lawyers. When they seek to enforce civil violations, what they're seeking to do, and there's a long line of literature on this, is to enforce a deterrence function and a general compensation function. They're not seeking to actually compensate specific victims of a particular wrongdoing. That would be a very ineffective way of doing that. Civil penalties for all sorts of reasons like collective action problems, principal agent problems, and a number of other economic sort of frictions, really bad way and inefficient way of trying to award specific redress to victims. A much better way to do that is to open up a private cause of action, which I suspect no one on this call wants to do, but that's a separate issue. I would just point out that in the absence of charitable payment provisions, you're not only going to undermine the actual goals of government lawyers of deterrence and general compensation, you're likely to force them into a situation where they're going to prosecute a lot more cases. So let's look again at the recent RMBS settlements. If these lawyers were not able to negotiate for multi-billion dollar settlements, it's much more likely they would have gone to court and sought the maximum in terms of civil and criminal penalties. And when you think about that from a capital formation perspective, from sort of an economic stability perspective, I think you can make the case that that's actually much worse for the companies involved than being able to settle. Taking away this type of negotiating tool also violates the first principle of negotiations. When you have a lawyer, you want that lawyer, when they're trying to make settlement negotiations, to have maximum flexibility to try to come up with the best deal possible. By taking away this major, major tool that they're using quite effectively, I think that you're going to open up a lot more politically forced or motivated prosecution as a result. So with that, I'll open this up for questions and turn it over to Dean again.
Thank you so much, both of you. Let's open the floor to questions. I do want to give Paul Larkin a chance to respond and rejoin the conversation. But first, we'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So if you have a question for either or perhaps both of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got a lot out there on the decks to respond to. Dr. Larkin, do you want to take a minute to respond to anything you heard? We don't have any questions yet from our audience.
Oh, sure. With respect to what David said, he broke it down into law and policy. With respect to law, he didn't point to any statute, and no one else has, that says this is permissible. They point principally to OLC opinions, that is, opinions by the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department. Well, I was at the Justice Department, and although we really wished OLC opinions were the law, they're not. What courts say is the law. Now, there is a case that people point to that says it's okay for the Justice Department to engage in this sort of practice, but the decision they point to, a decision by the Ninth Circuit, doesn't even discuss the Miscellaneous Receipts Act, so it's really not a good authority in this regard. Besides, the Supreme Court long ago, in a case called Ex Parte United States, said that courts don't have the authority to make up remedies that Congress has not authorized. Early in the 20th century, there was a practice that was developing in the states of placing defendants on probation rather than sending them to prison. Well, in the Ex Parte United States case, there was actually a mandatory sentence that had to be imposed, and the judge disregarded it and placed the defendant on probation. A unanimous Supreme Court said it's not up to courts, let alone to the Justice Department, to decide what the appropriate penalty scheme is. It's up to Congress, and Congress had not adopted probation. Now, probation came along later because we thought it was a good policy. And as David said, I think a lot of these sorts of organizations probably deserve some money, and it would be good for them to get it. But it has to go through the right legal process. Either they should be required to persuade Congress in individual cases that they should get appropriations, or they should be able to persuade Congress that this entire mechanism should be adopted. The problem is this has been adopted, and since nobody has objected to it, we don't really have any litigation over it. But the problem is there is no statutory authority for it, and the only relevant statutes both say you can't do this. So if this is a good policy, fine, persuade Congress to adopt it.
If I might respond, this is David Mann.
Please go right ahead.
So actually, there are some courts that have signed off on this reasoning. First of all, you have all the courts that have approved the settlements. So these settlements, they're used a lot. This is not a recent phenomenon that started with Clinton or Obama. This goes all the way back to the 70s, as I mentioned. Courts have signed off on these for several decades at this point. More importantly, there is a Supreme Court case, local number 93, AFL-CIO v. City of Cleveland in 1986, unrelated to the essence of this matter, but the logic is relevant here. What it states is that any settlements of litigation claims are best understood as voluntary mutual agreements akin to contracts. And so it is the agreement of the parties rather than the force of law upon which the complaint was originally based, which creates the binding obligation. In other words, when you have a settlement that is essentially a contract, you're untethered from any statutory basis. So the Ninth Circuit case that I think that Dr. Larkin is referring to is Sierra Club v. Electronic Controls Design, and that takes essentially the logic of the Supreme Court and applies it to government settlements with these third-party payments. But, of course, that particular decision has never been challenged or overturned. In fact, it's been affirmed by a number of other circuits and lower courts. More importantly, Congress itself has never said this is a problem. And there is a statute, contrary to Dr. Larkin's claim, that governs, and it is the Miscellaneous Receipts Act. And there's a deep body of analysis and case law that examines that and what it means. And I think the analysis I gave earlier fairly summarizes that. You actually have to receive the money or constructively have to have been in receipt of the money for it to count as an appropriable sum of money. If you never received it, either actually or constructively, you can't be said to be under any appropriations guidelines as to that money. And so that's the governing logic that applies not just these settlements to many other types of things as well. If you want to change the law, that is the law today, there are ways to change it. One of those is the bill, H.R. 5063, and I just point out the fact that that bill exists and was passed out of Congress to me very strongly indicates, or passed out of the House Judiciary Committee, strongly indicates that Congress itself is ceding to the point that this is the law today. If we want to get rid of this practice, we're going to have to change the statutes.
Let me make another call for questions. If you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got plenty of time for questions. Let me, while we're waiting, make a quick announcement as to our upcoming schedule. Tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern at this same number, we'll be talking about cell site simulators and law enforcement. That's a mechanism that law enforcement can use to track locations of cell phone users. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern time. Wednesday, we'll be talking about the Internet of Things, and that's at 2 o'clock Wednesday, and Thursday at 1, what's next in the area of compulsory union dues. Today, of course, we're talking to two experts, and we're talking about settlement funds in federal matters. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We start with one caller today.
Hi, my question is for Mr. Larkin. My question is, to what extent are your arguments also applicable to settlements by state attorneys general, such as the recent announced Volkswagen settlement, that also contain large amounts of money that are directed to an attorney general's office and distributed outside of the state appropriations process?
Well, the Miscellaneous Receipts Act requires that something be in the actual or constructive possession of some federal official. So if a state attorney general is the only government official involved, the Miscellaneous Receipts Act wouldn't apply. In fact, there was a case where both the United States and the state of Virginia brought suit, and the Office of Legal Counsel said that if all of a certain amount of the money in the settlement goes to Virginia and none of it goes to the United States, then that would not violate the act. I think that's a strained reading of the statute, but nonetheless, at least in that circumstance, they drew that sort of distinction. So I don't think what I'm talking about would apply. I was going to say, certainly, if the United States is not involved in the litigation, it couldn't apply. But, you know, even if it was, that other case gives you at least the Justice Department's opinion that it wouldn't.
I think this is David Min. I realize this was not to me, but just as I did some research in this line, and I think it is a highly variable set of state laws that apply to the power. But, of course, as Dr. Larkin says, federal law would not apply. It's really a state matter to what degree can these different types of settlements happen. And you hear about different abuses happening in different states all the time, but those are state law matters.
Once again, this is Dean Reuter. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone while we wait to see if we have another question from our audience. Let me ask maybe a factual question of either or both of our experts. I've heard that some of these agreements would provide something like 2-to-1 credit to the so that is, so for every dollar that a bank, for example, donates to one of the listed entities, it gets $2 of credit towards the settlement. I'm just wondering if that's factually correct. And my second question is, how often do these agreements take place? How often do we see them where there's a settlement that's augmented by some sort of contribution to a third party?
David, you want to go first? Go ahead.
Sure. On the 2-for-1, that is correct, although it's not like it's 2-for-1 civil penalties again. Just to sort of go back to my earlier point, these settlements were much larger in nominal amounts than the government probably could have gotten if it just sued for civil penalties. And so what ends up happening is there's a headline figure, you know, which is on the front page of the New York Times or Wall Street Journal. You know, it's about $2 billion, and maybe $800 million of that is made up of sort of helping out foreclosure prevention, neighborhood stabilization. But of that, you get subdivided into categories. So certain types of relief get more credit than others. Some of them get two times the credit as a typical donation. Some of them get less, and so it sort of depends. I believe the housing counseling donations did receive 2-for-1 on a couple of the different settlements. What was your second question again?
It was about the ubiquitousness of these settlements. How often?
Oh, yeah, I think they happen a lot. So they happen a lot, particularly in the EPA context, where there's this supplemental environmental project categorization they use. And the EPA actually encourages its attorneys to try to rely heavily on this charitable payment provision for a lot of different reasons, including it's less of a drain on litigation resources. People involved tend to view these as win-wins, and I guess that might be a follow-up question for Dr. Larkin, which is, you know, when I talk to people in industry about this or the DOJ, I think there's a lot of feeling that this can be a win-win situation because the private parties don't have to agree to these. It just opens up something that potentially can be a PR boon. It can sort of help them come to settlement and resolution of litigation uncertainty. And I guess that's why I'm prone to thinking these are good things as opposed to, from a policy perspective, bad things.
Well, let me respond to that. They can be good things. And I wouldn't have any problem with Congress setting up a program that allows, in essence, for an area that has been despoiled by someone to be treated, if you will, as a victim. Right now, the victim laws allow individual people who are hurt by a crime to receive some type of compensation. In the case of an environmental crime, which I used to be an agent investigating, you have an area that has been despoiled. And I don't have any problem with Congress saying you can put money into an organization as long as it's devoted to cleaning up this area. But that's a good idea for Congress to do. It's not a good idea for the Justice Department on its own to do, and here's why. As Dean pointed out, the housing settlement agreements give a 2-to-1 preference for certain types of recipients. That is directly the sort of problem that the Appropriations Clause was designed to deal with. You have the executive branch, rather than Congress, picking who should get financial benefits. And the Constitution was set up to prevent that risk of cronyism. It's not that Congress isn't subject to cronyism. I mean, you can't take politics out of a political institution. But the people get to elect representatives, and now they get to elect senators. They don't elect anyone at the Justice Department, including the Attorney General. So the appropriations power was taken from executive branch officials and given entirely to Congress to prevent the sort of cronyism that housing agreement 2-for-1 provision exemplifies.
I guess I would just push back and say I'm not sure I see the cronyism, given that J.P. Morgan Chase, let's just take them for example, they can donate to hundreds of different housing counseling groups, or they can donate to zero of them. But all of these different provisions were negotiated under intense negotiations. You have lawyers sitting around the table for weeks and weeks, if not months, talking about the particulars of what they want the final settlement to look like. I guess I'd just push back, and this is not a binary issue of it's going to be a two-for-one or not. Presumably, J.P. Morgan Chase was willing to, perhaps they pushed for that. I wasn't in the room with this when these were done. You weren't either. But I can certainly see the case being made that foreclosure prevention is a win-win for J.P. Morgan Chase, because the fewer foreclosures there are, the less in losses they end up taking on their overall book of business. Every foreclosure causes a 1% decline in the value of neighborhood properties. It increases foreclosures in the surrounding areas by a certain percentage. It has negative externalities that really redound. I could see J.P. Morgan Chase deciding it made economic sense, and DOJ deciding it made economic sense. But again, it's not something that's like an appropriation where we're going to allow this pot of money to this group. It's something where J.P. Morgan Chase has to agree. And if, for example, DOJ was able to negotiate a much higher baseline number for including this two-for-one for housing counseling, that would seem to make a lot of sense for them to take. And again, that gets to the problems with trying to parse out how the settlements went when these are very, very complex settlements negotiated, not just by Congress, but by two parties. This is two parties negotiating over alleged wrongdoing.
Yeah, 2 points in response. One is, anyone who settles a case is going to settle it with a certain dollar figure in mind as being the maximum amount that that party is willing to pay. So if the banks said $1 million is the maximum amount I'm willing to pay, and then they get a provision in there that says, but if I give it to a certain group of people, the effective payment is less than $1 million, they're going to jump at it. And if the Justice Department sees that the money is going to be paid over to friends of the administration, they're going to jump at it too. Not the career people. They don't care. They're taking orders from the political people up top. So if the banks can enter into this agreement and pay less than $1 million, and the Justice Department can see some of that money going to friends, that's exactly what cronyism is in this sort of circumstance. And that's why this is not supposed to happen. We don't have any oversight of a court involved in these things. There was no court involved in those negotiations. No court has addressed these issues. Basically,
sure, the courts have signed off on them.
Courts sign off on all sorts of things, and when the parties settle, what usually happens is the court says, "Well, if you guys are happy with it, so am I." Nobody in the courtroom is going to object to one of these deals. Additional problem, let me just add, the second point I was going to make is, the problem here is this money goes to organizations that may wind up using it for political purposes.
That's a categorically incorrect statement.
No, it's not true.
They're all being audited.
The Justice Department is not auditing people who get these monies. They've said they can't audit them, because if they did, that would amount to supervision.
You have a monitor appointed that is monitoring the use of this, and every group receiving this money is having their books looked at, not only by the monitor, by the way, but all these groups as housing counseling groups also have various state and federal oversight of how they spend their money because of that whole 501c3 versus 4 versus whatever classification. The categorization that this is some slush fund that they can use that money for whatever they want is not a legally correct one. I mean, it's just not a factually correct one.
No, it is, for this reason. They have a limited
amount
of money.
Do you have evidence that that's happening? Because I can point to the different folks auditing the books of these particular organizations, as well as the monitor that is appointed as part of the settlement. Now, unless you're saying that they're all intentionally, nefariously falling asleep on the job, I think you have a fairly robust oversight mechanism without any evidence that that oversight mechanism is failing.
No. If this were a discrimination case, the Justice Department would take the position that any money somebody gets subjects them to all of the anti-discrimination laws. What you have here is a circumstance where they're getting money that adds to the amount of money they can expend on whatever purposes they're engaged in, which then frees up funds they get from elsewhere to use for other purposes. An audit that looks to see that the $10,000 they receive in the settlement goes only to whatever the organization's main purpose is, say helping people avoid foreclosure, doesn't look to see where the rest of the money from that organization goes. They now have, let's say, $2 million and $10,000. Even if all that $10,000 goes entirely to helping people avoid foreclosure, that's $10,000 that they don't have to use from the $2 million they get elsewhere for whatever purposes they want. And no one's auditing that.
Well, they are, because you're not allowed to engage in political purposes if you're a housing counseling nonprofit. You have a separate organization which may have the same name. So La Raza is a perfect example. La Raza has a political arm, and then they have a housing counseling nonprofit arm. If the housing counseling nonprofit arm engages in political activity, as James Keefe, you know, and others have highlighted, those folks get in trouble for that. That's breaking the law. This is not a slush fund. Now, perhaps there are people using things in slightly different ways than they should, but the fact is there are laws on the books to prevent the nonprofit aspects of these organizations from using any of their money for political purposes.
Once again, if you're there, an audience, if you have a question,
and I'll,
push the star
and I did want to respond to the earlier
button.
Point. It's not a one for one. That's one point I want to make. This is the basic principle of negotiations: is you try to maximize your own benefit, and the best negotiations outcomes are not zero sum games where it's like I take a dollar from you, you give up a dollar. It's coming to a mutually beneficial outcome. For example, let me just posit a hypothetical. Again, stressing that neither of us are aware of the particulars of what's going on with these settlements, but a hypothetical in which J.P. Morgan Chase was already planning to donate $100 million to housing counseling groups this year, because that's as a PR benefit and perhaps to help prevent foreclosures, which is its own interest. In that scenario, they would be willing to give up a lot more in housing counseling than they might otherwise. It's not taking away part of $1 million and giving part of $1 million back to DOJ. It really does expand the size of the pot, as I pointed out. The DOJ got massively larger settlements than they would have probably gotten if they just simply settled at the maximum of the civil penalties. They really expanded the size of that overall highlighted settlement number to billions of dollars. I don't think any lawyer out there, even the most creative ones at DOJ, could have gotten to that figure just on the basis of civil penalties alone.
Let me. This is Dean Reuter. Again, if you have a question in the audience, our lines are wide open. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me ask a quick question that sort of goes to that. I think you've said three times now, Professor Min, that through these mechanisms, the Department of Justice is able to get settlements beyond what the statute might allow. That's what I'm hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm mishearing that. But
no, that's correct.
Okay, so maybe there's a separation of powers question here. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but it seems to me that it's the job of Congress to define the parameters of incentives and penalties and deterrent effects. And mm-hmm. if they've said that the maximum here is, you know, $2,000 per incident times, you know, 1,000 customers, we get to $2 million or whatever it is. Is the Department of Justice expanding the penalty beyond Congress's intent, or even beyond its stated wishes here?
Yeah, they absolutely are. And the only thing you can sort of say in defense of that practice is that what the company is getting is they're avoiding a finding of admission, right, or guilt. So they're probably avoiding some amount of criminal prosecution as well. So even though they didn't settle these criminal cases, it probably obviates the prosecution to some degree of criminal claims. It also allows them to avoid that finding of guilt or admission that then could be used against them in other civil proceedings by private parties or states. So they do get something out of that might incentivize them to give more than the maximum civil penalties. I guess if you're looking at this as DOJ going beyond their limits, that's an interesting policy question. Again, settlements have been widely blessed by the courts as essentially something like a private contract between two parties. I think there's some interesting policy arguments in that regard that I think, go a little bit beyond the scope of today's call, but are interesting ones nonetheless.
Do you see a legal question there as well as a policy question, or not?
I mean, under current law, again, unless we change it, my understanding is that settlements have been largely blessed as giving a lot of agency to the parties involved, including when that one of the parties is the federal government. You know, you have this dicta repeated over and over by the Supreme Court and others that settlements can be outside of the underlying statutory violation because these are essentially private agreements between two parties.
Right, right. Once again, our lines are still wide open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button. And let me ask one other factual question. I have read or heard elsewhere that in some instances, some of the groups on the list, maybe some of the groups that have actually been funded, and I'm talking about the third-party groups here, are entities that had at one point in time, maybe even recently, been receiving federal funds but had been defunded by Congress. So in other words, you have a group A who's just been had their federal funds withdrawn, and through one of these settlement agreements, they get some level of funding reinstituted. Is that factually correct? And if it is there an optics problem? Does it strengthen the appropriations argument one way or another?
Is that a question for Dr. Larkin?
Either one of you, whoever wants to respond, or both of you. Professor, you want to take it?
Sure. I suspect Dr. Larkin will want some time to respond as well, because he and I will have different views on this. Again, at least legally, and I think for me from a policy perspective, this is a payment by a private party to another private party negotiated as part of a settlement. It's not actually federal or taxpayer money. Do you want a policy saying, let me step back, and you know, Dr. Larkin has posited these different scenarios in which the government is taking a one-for-one. Let me posit a different scenario in which J.P. Morgan Chase says to the government, we're going to give you $1 million. That's our maximum. But we'll also give you another $10 million in payments to third-party charities if you reduce our penalty by $1. I think almost all of us would take that, assuming that the $10 million was to causes that were good, and as I mentioned earlier, the requirements are that there must be some nexus between that payment and the underlying violation. I think you would have to be a fool to not take that. And I suspect the truth falls somewhere between my scenario and Dr. Larkin's scenario. But I think, again, this is best thought of as J.P. Morgan Chase agreeing to give something up that it's more willing to give up in order to maximize the size of the overall pie. Lots of negotiations literature in the last 20, 30 years pointing out the importance of trying to emphasize, expand the pie type thinking rather than zero-sum thinking when it comes to negotiating legal settlements. And so that would sort of be my approach to it when I think about that issue.
Dr. Larkin.
I can't imagine a general counsel keeping that job for very long who says, the most my company is willing to pay is $1 million, but I'll give you $11 million, or I'll pay $11 million as long as you take away $1,000 from that.
Well, if they were planning to give the $10 million anyway, or if they were planning to give $8 million, and they feel like it's a PR benefit to give money to third parties, that's not a general counsel decision, by the way. That's probably coming from the principals in the C-suite, all the time. Maybe it gives them CRA credit?
Wherever it comes from, if they're going to give that extra $10 million, they're going to get a tax credit for that. They're not going to get a tax credit as part of this settlement agreement, and the tax credit for giving $10 million is going to be greatly in excess of the $1,000 deduction they get for entering into the settlement.
Was that a question?
No, I'm saying that's what's going to happen. If you give $10 million to a charitable organization, you get a tax benefit for that. It's going to be greater than $1,000. So they're not going to package this benefit to a private organization that's a charity as part of a settlement where they're not going to get a tax credit for that.
They might, depending on sort of the purposes of it. Some of these are for CRA requirements, regulatory requirements. Benefits. Some of them are just for goodwill. And again, as I mentioned earlier, in the case of housing counseling, which is the boogeyman at issue here, There's a lot of evidence that housing counseling helps improve the overall books of the banks themselves, particularly large banks of the types that did these types of settlements, because they've got massive exposure to the housing markets, and anything that prevents foreclosures and loss mitigation and neighborhood destabilization benefits their overall book of business. I mean, that's just sort of Econ 101 or Risk Management 101 at these institutions. And so it's not the same as, you know, giving $10 million to housing counseling groups is not the same as giving $10 million to the federal government.
Once again, maybe this will be our final call for questions.
Sure. Here.
Push the star button and the pound button on your phone if you have a question and if you're in the audience. Seeing none, I will ask yet another question. This is Dean Reuter again. From where does the list of the third parties come? And then I have a question sort of based on my experience in government. I've been in the Inspector General's office in a couple grant-making agencies. I even am on the board presently of a grant-making agency of the federal government. What exactly are the powers, as closely as you can describe them, of the monitor? Before we give a grant out, there's a vetting process, there's an application process, there's a description of what you're going to do with the money. It's all pretty exacting. There's the grant review process, there's a peer review process, and then there's on-site monitoring and desk auditing and things like that. What's the extent of the monitor's power in these circumstances? Can they, for example, get somebody off the list, an effective debarment? So if you could speak to that, either one of you, and again, I'd be happy to hear from either one of you on this.
I think David is more familiar with that than I am.
Okay.
I'd say I want to thank you all for inviting me, and I guess this is more interesting to Dr. Larkin and myself than it is maybe to the general masses, but thank you for having us, and thank you, Dr. Larkin. As far as the two housing counseling group question, my understanding is that all these agreements were negotiated specifically to say that any HUD-approved housing counseling group, and so you can go to the HUD webpage, and any group that they have approved as being worthy, certified, et cetera. And again, I would stress, my understanding of that is it's not an ideological process, despite the fact that it is the Obama administration that is in charge of HUD. The goal of that certification is to make sure you don't have scam artists out there posing as housing counseling groups. And of course, we've seen a lot of that in the post-mortgage crisis landscape of the last 10 years. So it's basically HUD is the short answer. As far as the monitors, it depends, but they are supposed to essentially have control, audit the books. It's a deeply intimate process. One of the criticisms, by the way, that I actually think is a good one, is that potentially the process by which the monitor is appointed is one that has no oversight whatsoever and has actually often been used as a quid pro quo. Much more clearly, there's actual evidence that this happens fairly often than there is that of the sort of slush fund claims. So, for example, you've seen law firms with sort of ex-HUD officials or ex-DOJ officials get jobs repeatedly as monitors. You've seen Chris Christie in that infamous example pointed one of his buddies as the monitor in, I think, the New Jersey state settlement over something. And so this type of process happens quite a lot. And I think that is actually something where if we, in my view, if you want to target this overall settlement process, who gets appointed monitor and how might be a place to start.
A final thought then from each of you. We've run out of questions from the audience, but let's sort of go in reverse order than we started. And Professor Min, you have a final thought.
I think I've said what I'd like, but thank you again for having me, and I'm sorry there was not more active participation among the audience.
Dr. Larkin, a final thought before we adjourn?
Paul would be satisfactory. It's been a great debate. David's a fun fellow. He's very bright, very engaged, and so I've enjoyed the back and forth. But at bottom, I think the policy arguments are far less important than the legal ones because they're directed to the wrong forum. They shouldn't be directed to us. They should be directed to Congress. Congress should be the one to make these decisions.
Very good. I want to thank you both on behalf of the Federal Society and on my own behalf. This has been an engaging and entertaining discussion. To the audience, thank you for dialing in. We've had quite a few of you on the phone, but not that many questions. A reminder to the audience that our next scheduled call is tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be talking about cell site simulators. But until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.